It's 1994. A 30-year-old quantitative analyst at D.E. Shaw, one of the most prestigious hedge funds in New York, is sitting at his desk reading a report. The report says that internet usage is growing at 2,300% per year. 2,300%. He reads the number again. He's never seen a growth rate like this for anything.
Jeff Bezos closes his eyes and projects himself forward to age 80. He's an old man looking back on his life. He asks himself, will I regret not trying this? He already knows the answer. He won't regret trying and failing. He'll regret not trying. He'll regret staying at the hedge fund, making money, being comfortable, and knowing for the rest of his life that he saw the wave and didn't paddle out.
He quits. His boss, David Shaw, the computer scientist who founded the firm, a brilliant man who fully understands what Bezos is seeing, tries to talk him out of it. They take a walk through Central Park. Shaw tells Bezos to think about it for 48 hours. Bezos thinks about it and quits anyway.
He and his wife Mackenzie pack up their apartment. They drive to Seattle. And here's the detail that captures who Bezos is. Mackenzie drives. Jeff sits in the passenger seat the entire way, writing the business plan on a laptop. He's not wasting the transit time. He's building the company before they arrive.
Of course he is. The man who will build the most relentless company in the history of retail is writing the business plan from the passenger seat of a cross-country road trip.
He registers a company called Relentless.com, briefly considers Kadabra, until his lawyer mishears it as Cadaver on the phone and settles on Amazon, named after the world's largest river. Starts with A, implies scale. He builds a website in his garage to sell books.
Books, just books. The man who would build the everything store started with the most boring product category you can imagine. And that was the genius of it.
Welcome back to Silicon Valley Strategy. I'm Myra D'Amico.
And I'm Travis Carlyle. This is episode 10. So a hedge fund analyst quits his job, takes a walk through Central Park, writes his business plan from the passenger seat of a cross-country drive, registers Relentless.com, and starts selling books out of a garage in Seattle. That's the origin story of the Everything Store.
And today we're doing Amazon Part 1, the founding, the flywheel, the long game, and the decisions that turned an online bookstore into the most consequential company in e-commerce history.
I want to set expectations up front. We're going to spend a lot of time on decisions that seem simple in retrospect. Why books? Why Prime? Why the marketplace? Because the simplicity is deceptive. Every one of these decisions involved rejecting a more obvious alternative, and the reasoning behind each rejection is where the strategic insight lives.
Before we dive in, trivia. And this one is about the naming of the company, because it reveals something about Bezos' psychology. Listeners, here's the question. Before settling on Amazon, Bezos registered a different domain name that he seriously considered using as the company name. If you type that domain into your browser today, it still redirects to Amazon. What's the domain?
Love this one.
Pause now if you want to guess. The answer, relentless.com. Bezos registered it in 1994, and to this day, right now, you can do this. If you type relentless.com into your browser, it redirects to amazon.com. He also considered Kadabra, as in abracadabra, but his lawyer, Todd Tarbert, misheard it as cadaver during a phone call, which Bezos took as a sign that the name would cause confusion.
The choice of Amazon over Relentless is revealing. Relentless describes Bezos's personality. Amazon describes his ambition. The Amazon River is the largest river in the world by discharge volume. Bezos wanted a name that implied scale, not just large, but the largest. And starting with the letter A was deliberate. In the early internet era, many directories and lists were organized alphabetically. Starting with A meant Amazon appeared first.
And the relentless redirect is the kind of detail that Bezos would preserve. It's a private joke that's persisted for 30 years. The man who built the most relentless company in the history of retail almost named it that.
Which honestly would have been more honest.
Fair.
But less marketable. Though I have to say, Everyone listening should actually go type relentless.com into their browser right now. It's one of those little Easter eggs that tells you more about a founder's personality than any shareholder letter ever could.
The fact that it still redirects after 30 years, that's commitment to a joke. Or maybe it's not a joke at all.
With Bezos, it's never a joke.
I want to note one more thing about the origin story. Bezos was at D.E. Shaw, which wasn't just any hedge fund. Shaw was one of the earliest firms to apply quantitative analysis to financial markets. The culture was data-driven, analytical, rigorous, and Bezos' approach to Amazon, obsessive measurement, long-term quantitative thinking, willingness to accept short-term losses for long-term mathematical inevitability, that approach comes directly from his hedge fund training. He ran Amazon like a quant would run a retailer.
Which is to say, unlike anyone had ever run a retailer before.
That origin story tells us who Bezos is. Now let's set the context for what he walked into. It's 1994. What does the commercial internet look like?
It barely exists. The World Wide Web has been public for about 3 years. Mosaic, the first mainstream web browser, launched in 1993. Netscape Navigator will launch in December 1994. There are approximately 2,500 websites in existence. E-commerce, as a category, is essentially theoretical.
The infrastructure for online transactions is primitive. SSL, Secure Sockets Layer, the encryption technology that makes it safe to transmit credit card numbers online, has just been developed by Netscape. Most consumers have never bought anything online. Most consumers have never been online. Home internet access is dial-up, 14.4 or 28.8 modems. Loading a web page with images takes minutes.
And yet Bezos sees the 2,300% growth rate and makes a bet that is, in retrospect, one of the most prescient strategic decisions of the century. He doesn't bet that the internet will be important someday. He bets that the internet is important right now, that the growth rate implies a massive near-term opportunity, and that being early to e-commerce will create advantages that later entrants can't replicate.
Put yourself in the shoes of any rational observer in 1994. The internet has 2,500 websites. Nobody shops online. The technology is slow and unreliable. Credit card fraud is a genuine concern. And a hedge fund analyst wants to quit his job to sell books on the internet. Books which you can buy at any bookstore for immediate gratification. The idea sounds, to be frank, insane.
And Bezos knows it sounds insane. That's the point of the regret minimization framework. He's not arguing that success is certain. He's arguing that the expected value of trying exceeds the expected value of not trying when you weight the outcomes by the regret they generate. The worst case of trying is that you fail and go back to finance. The worst case of not trying is that you spend the rest of your life knowing you saw it and didn't act.
It's worth noting that this isn't a general purpose framework. It works for Bezos because his personal cost of failure is low. He's a Princeton-educated hedge fund analyst. He can always get another job. And his personal cost of regret is high. For someone with less financial security or less tolerance for uncertainty, the calculus might be different.
Fair point. The regret minimization framework is a tool for people who can afford to fail, which in 1994, Bezos could.
But the broader retail landscape, what does it look like? This is the era of Walmart's dominance. Walmart has revenues of about $80 billion. Barnes & Noble is the dominant bookstore chain. Borders is its main competitor. The average Barnes & Noble superstore stocks about 175,000 titles. The entire bookstore industry carries a few hundred thousand unique titles.
And books in print, the total number of titles available from publishers, is over 3 million. So even the largest bookstore in the country carries less than 6% of available titles. This is the insight that Bezos will exploit. The physical store is constrained by shelf space. The internet isn't. The question that most people ask about Amazon's founding is, why books? And the answer isn't that Bezos loved books, although he did. The answer is mathematical.
And this is where the hedge fund analyst shows himself. Bezos didn't start with a product and figure out how to sell it. He started with a framework and found the product that fit best. He made a list of 20 product categories that could be sold online: books, music, videos, computer hardware, computer software, and he evaluated each category against 5 specific criteria. 20 categories, 5 criteria. It's a matrix, not an inspiration.
That's such a Bezos move. Other people in 1994 are saying the internet is cool, let's sell something. Bezos is building a 20x5 decision matrix.
And books one on every dimension. Let's walk through the criteria, because this analysis is what separates Bezos from every other person who thought about e-commerce in 1994.
Criterion 1, product diversity. How many unique items exist in the category? Books had over 3 million titles in print. No other consumer category had comparable diversity. More diversity means a larger selection advantage for an online store, because the gap between what a physical store can stock and what an online store can offer is wider.
Criterion 2, commoditization. A book is a book. A copy of The Great Gatsby from Amazon is identical to a copy from Barnes & Noble. There's no quality uncertainty, no need to touch or try the product before buying. This eliminates the biggest barrier to online shopping, the fear that what you receive won't match what you expected.
Criterion 3, price sensitivity. Books are relatively inexpensive. A $15 book is a low-risk purchase for a first-time online shopper. You're not asking someone to trust a new technology with a $1,000 purchase. You're asking them to risk $15. The barrier to trial is low.
Criterion 4, the existing distribution infrastructure. Book publishers had already consolidated distribution through a handful of major wholesalers, Ingram and Baker & Taylor, the two dominant book distribution wholesalers in the U.S. Amazon didn't need to negotiate with thousands of individual publishers. It could order from 2 or 3 wholesalers and get access to the entire catalog. This made the initial logistics manageable.
And Criterion 5, this is the one I think is the genuine insight, the selection asymmetry. A physical bookstore is constrained by floor space. The largest Barnes & Noble stocks 175,000 titles. Amazon, operating from a warehouse, could theoretically offer every book in print, over 3 million titles. That's an 18-to-1 selection advantage. No other product category had a selection asymmetry this large.
What gets me about this analysis is how rigorous it is. 20 categories against 5 criteria. Bezos didn't start with an emotional attachment to books. He started with a framework. What product category maximizes the structural advantage of an online store over a physical store? And books were the output. The decision was analytical, not romantic.
And the analytical approach carries through to every subsequent Amazon decision. This is a company that is, at its core, a quantitative operation masquerading as a retailer.
Which, by the way, is exactly why the dot-com bubble casualties we talked about 2 episodes ago couldn't compete with Amazon. They were retailers trying to use technology. Amazon was a technology company that happened to sell things. The organizational DNA was fundamentally different.
Same products, same internet, completely different species of company.
Now we get to the concept that defines Amazon's strategy from founding to the present day. Bezos drew it on a napkin, and versions of that drawing have circulated through business schools ever since. The flywheel.
Let me describe it precisely. Start with lower prices. Lower prices attract more customers. More customers attract more third-party sellers to the marketplace. More sellers offer more product selection. More selection makes the platform more valuable. The increased volume allows Amazon to spread fixed costs over more units, which lowers the cost structure, which allows lower prices. The loop feeds itself.
And every element reinforces every other element. It's not a linear sequence. It's a closed loop. Once it starts spinning, each rotation generates the force for the next rotation. The faster it spins, the harder it is to stop, and the harder it is for a competitor to create a counter flywheel, because they'd need to match Amazon on selection, price, and volume simultaneously.
But the flywheel is the visible part of the strategy. There's a hidden mechanism underneath that makes it financially possible, and most people miss it entirely.
Negative working capital.
Explain this, because it's one of the most underappreciated concepts in Amazon's success, and it connects directly to the Dell story from episode 5.
When a customer buys a product on Amazon, their credit card is charged immediately. Amazon collects the money on day 1, but Amazon doesn't pay its suppliers immediately. payment terms with suppliers are typically 30 to 90 days, sometimes longer. So Amazon has the customer's cash in its bank account for 30 to 90 days before it needs to pay the supplier. And in those 30 to 90 days, Amazon uses that cash to fund operations, build infrastructure, expand into new categories, and invest in growth.
I want to make sure everyone hears what Myra just described, because this is one of those concepts that sounds simple but has profound implications. Amazon gets paid before it pays its suppliers. That gap is free money. And the faster Amazon grows, the more free money it generates. It's a financial perpetual motion machine.
Exactly. And this is what connects Amazon to the Dell story. Remember Dell's negative cash conversion cycle from episode 5? Negative 36 days. Dell had the customer's money for 36 days before paying anyone. Amazon has the same structural advantage, but with a critical difference. Dell was in a mature, low-growth category. Amazon had negative working capital with revenue growing 50, 100, 200% per year. When you combine a growing float with hypergrowth, the absolute amount of free capital available for investment increases dramatically every year.
If you run the math, it's extraordinary. As Amazon's revenue grows, the float, the gap between cash received and cash paid, grows proportionally. Hundreds of millions, then billions of dollars sitting in Amazon's bank account at any given time, belonging economically to suppliers who haven't yet been paid but available to Amazon for investment. It's effectively an interest-free loan from suppliers that scales automatically with revenue.
And this is structurally different from traditional retail. Walmart also has payment terms with suppliers, but Walmart has to stock inventory in thousands of physical stores, which ties up enormous amounts of capital in goods sitting on shelves. Amazon's warehouse model is more capital efficient because it centralizes inventory, reducing the total amount of stock needed to serve the same level of demand.
So Amazon has lower inventory carrying costs and a larger float relative to revenue. The combination means Amazon generates cash from its operations, even when its income statement shows losses. This is the financial mechanism that allowed Bezos to invest aggressively for years while Wall Street saw red ink. Bezos saw a growing pile of free capital funded by his own customers and suppliers.
Well, I want to push back slightly. Is negative working capital really unique to Amazon? Walmart has it. Dell famously had it. Many retailers manage working capital aggressively.
You're right that negative working capital isn't unique. What's unique is the combination of negative working capital with the flywheel growth model. The float funds the investments that spin the flywheel faster. The faster flywheel generates more revenue. More revenue generates more float. More float funds, more investments. The negative working capital isn't just a financial advantage, it's the fuel that powers the flywheel. They're inseparable.
That's a really important distinction. The flywheel is the strategy. The negative working capital is the financing mechanism that makes the strategy executable. Most companies have one or the other. Amazon has both, and they reinforce each other. In 1997, Amazon goes public. The stock price is at $18 a share, and Bezos writes a letter to shareholders that'll become, and I don't think this is hyperbole, the most cited document in the history of technology business.
The most cited?
It's up there with the Intel memo and Jobs' Stanford speech. Every founder, every VC, every MBA student who wants to understand long-term thinking in technology eventually reads this letter. It's been reprinted, analyzed, taught in classrooms, quoted in board meetings. And the reason is that Bezos doesn't just describe Amazon's strategy. He creates a public commitment device that aligns investors, employees, and the company around a single principle.
The letter's subject line, it's all about the long term. And the letter lays out Amazon's operating philosophy in explicit detail. Bezos writes that Amazon will prioritize long-term market leadership over short-term profitability, that it'll make investment decisions based on long-term value creation, even when those investments aren't well understood by short-term focused investors, that it'll measure itself on cash flow, not earnings, and that it'll continue to invest aggressively and incur losses as long as the investments improve the customer experience and strengthen the competitive position.
What gets me about the letter is that Bezos isn't apologizing for the losses. He's arguing that the losses are the strategy, Every dollar not reported as profit is a dollar reinvested in infrastructure, technology, logistics, and customer experience that'll compound over decades. He's telling Wall Street, if you want short-term profits, don't buy this stock. If you want long-term value creation, we're going to build the most formidable competitive position in the history of retail.
And he reattaches the original 1997 letter to every subsequent annual letter, every year for 27 years and counting. The message is, nothing has changed. We said what we meant what we said.
That consistency is itself a strategic act. By reattaching the letter every year, Bezos is selecting his investor base. Investors who want quarterly earnings see the letter and sell. Investors who believe in long-term compounding see the letter and buy. Over time, Amazon ends up with a shareholder base that supports patient capital allocation instead of demanding short-term returns. The letter isn't just communication. It's a filter.
And this is the connection between the 1997 letter and the flywheel. The flywheel requires patient capital. Lower prices today mean lower margins today. Infrastructure investment today means costs today. The returns come later, in customer loyalty, in scale economics, in competitive position. If your shareholders are demanding profits now, you can't run the flywheel. The 1997 letter gave Bezos permission to run the flywheel at the expense of near-term earnings, and the negative working capital gave him the cash to actually do it.
So you've got the flywheel as the strategy, the negative working capital as the financing, and the 1997 letter as the permission structure. Three interlocking pieces. Remove any one, and Amazon doesn't work.
Now, Amazon Prime. This is 2005. Amazon launches Prime, $79 a year for free two-day shipping on eligible items. And the internal debate at Amazon was ferocious because the shipping costs were real. Two-day shipping is expensive. If customers use it frequently, the cost per customer exceeds the $79 annual fee. The finance team projected significant losses.
Bezos overruled the objections. His argument was that Prime would change customer behavior, and this is the flywheel at work. Prime wasn't a shipping program. It was a behavioral modification tool designed to accelerate the flywheel. Once you've paid $79 for a year of free shipping, every subsequent purchase on Amazon feels like it comes with free shipping. Even though you've already paid for it, the marginal purchase has zero perceived shipping cost. This shifts the customer's mental accounting from, should I buy this on Amazon and pay for shipping, to, I might as well buy it on Amazon since shipping is free.
And the behavioral data bore this out immediately. Prime members shopped more frequently and spent more per year than non-Prime members. The numbers that have leaked over the years suggest that Prime members spend roughly 4 times as much annually as non-members. The $79 fee wasn't a revenue stream. It was a customer behavior modification tool.
That's one of the most brilliant pieces of behavioral design I've encountered in this course. $79 to fundamentally rewire how 100 million people think about shopping. The cost per behavioral change is pennies. And once the behavior changes, Prime members are locked in, not by contract, but by psychology. The sunk cost of the annual fee, plus the accumulation of benefits, free shipping, Prime Video, Prime Music, Prime Reading, makes cancellation feel like losing something rather than saving something.
And the retention rates are extraordinary. Prime renewal rates are estimated at over 90%. Once a customer signs up, they almost never cancel. Prime doesn't just accelerate the flywheel, it locks customers into it.
So Prime is simultaneously a flywheel accelerator, a switching cost mechanism, and a behavioral lock-in device. Three strategic functions in one product.
The last major strategic move in this era is the third-party marketplace. Amazon opens its platform to third-party sellers, competitors essentially, allowing them to list products alongside Amazon's own inventory. This is controversial. Why would you let competitors sell on your platform?
And the answer is because it accelerates the flywheel. Three reasons. First, selection. Amazon can't stock every product in every category. Third-party sellers fill gaps in the catalog. More selection attracts more customers. Second, data. Every third-party sale on Amazon generates data about demand, pricing, and customer preferences. Amazon uses this data to decide which products to stock directly, which categories to enter, and how to price its own offerings. The marketplace is, among other things, a massive real-time market research engine.
Well, and third, commission revenue. Amazon takes a percentage of every third-party sale, typically 15%, plus fulfillment fees if the seller uses FBA, Fulfillment by Amazon. This is high-margin revenue that scales with marketplace volume and requires no inventory investment from Amazon.
The marketplace decision is one of the most counterintuitive strategic moves in the history of retail. Amazon invited competitors onto its platform and made money from their sales, learned from their data, and occasionally used that learning to compete directly against them. It's a strategy that only works if you've got the platform leverage to dictate terms. And Amazon did.
The sellers know this. They know Amazon is using their data. They know Amazon might launch a competing product. And they stay on the platform anyway, because Amazon has the customers. The marketplace is where the buyers are. A seller who refuses to sell on Amazon out of principle is a seller who's invisible to hundreds of millions of consumers. The leverage is structural.
This is the same dynamic we saw with the App Store in the Apple episode. Developers know Apple takes 30%. They know the rules can change at any time. They stay because the customers are there. When you control the marketplace, the participants complain loudly and comply completely.
Platform power. It's the defining dynamic of the 21st century economy.
The last beat I want to hit is the Kindle, because it reveals something about how Bezos thinks about platform risk. In 2007, Amazon launches the Kindle, a dedicated e-reader with an e-ink display and a built-in cellular connection for downloading books.
The Kindle is a defensive move, and it connects back to the flywheel. Amazon's core business is selling physical products, and the largest category is books. If Apple, which has just launched the iPhone and is building an ecosystem that includes media distribution through iTunes, if Apple controls the ebook platform, Amazon loses its most important category. The Kindle ensures that Amazon, not Apple, controls the ebook experience. It's flywheel protection.
And Bezos prices the Kindle hardware at or below cost, the same strategy as game consoles, the same strategy as Gillette razors. The hardware is the acquisition mechanism. The ebook purchases are the monetization mechanism. This is the playbook Amazon will repeat with the Echo, the Fire TV Stick, and eventually Alexa.
The Kindle also foreshadows Amazon's broader strategy of entering hardware whenever a platform shift threatens its distribution advantage. If the platform shifts from web to mobile, Amazon builds a mobile app. If the platform shifts from mobile to voice, Amazon builds the Echo. If the platform shifts to AR or VR, Amazon will build something for that too. The company's core competency isn't hardware. It's ensuring that no platform shift separates Amazon from the customer.
And that's the flywheel thinking applied to competitive threats. Every platform shift that could slow the flywheel gets neutralized by vertical integration. The flywheel isn't just a growth model, it's a decision-making framework for the entire company.
Seven powers for Amazon Part 1, Helmer's framework for durable competitive advantage. And I'd argue that Amazon, like Microsoft, has multiple simultaneous powers, but the composition is different. And the way they reinforce each other is what makes Amazon nearly impossible to attack.
Make the case.
Power 1, scale economies. Amazon's logistics network is the foundational scale economy. More order volume means more delivery routes, which means lower per unit delivery cost. More volume means better negotiating leverage with carriers, UPS, FedEx, USPS. More volume justifies building dedicated fulfillment centers closer to customers, which reduces delivery time and cost simultaneously. This isn't a theoretical scale economy. It's a physical, infrastructure-based scale economy that requires billions of dollars of investment to replicate. And Amazon's been building it for 25 years.
And the scale economy feeds back into the flywheel. Each new fulfillment center doesn't just reduce costs, it also reduces delivery times, which improves customer experience, which drives more purchases, which justifies more fulfillment centers. The infrastructure investment is the flywheel.
Power 2, switching costs. Amazon Prime is the switching cost mechanism, and we saw how it operates on multiple levels in the story. At the financial level, the annual fee is a sunk cost that makes purchasing from competitors feel like waste. You've already paid for free shipping on Amazon. At the behavioral level, Prime has trained hundreds of millions of consumers to default to Amazon for every purchase. The search behavior starts on Amazon, not Google. For product queries, at the ecosystem level, Prime bundles shipping with video, music, reading, photos. Each additional benefit raises the cost of cancellation.
So, and there's an interesting psychological asymmetry here. Signing up for Prime feels like gaining something. Free shipping, streaming, benefits. Canceling Prime feels like losing all of those things. Loss aversion means the perceived cost of cancellation exceeds the perceived benefit of the original subscription. People stay because leaving hurts more than staying costs.
Power 3. Network economies. The third-party marketplace is a two-sided network. More sellers attract more buyers because of increased selection. More buyers attract more sellers because of increased customer base. The marketplace has reached a scale. Over 60% of Amazon's unit sales come from third-party sellers, where the network effect is self-sustaining. A new e-commerce platform trying to replicate Amazon's marketplace would need to simultaneously attract millions of sellers and hundreds of millions of buyers. This is the chicken and egg problem that killed every Amazon marketplace competitor.
eBay had a similar network effect, but eBay's marketplace was primarily auction-based and focused on unique or used items. Amazon's marketplace is fixed price and focused on new commodity items. The two networks occupied different niches, which is why both survived.
Power 4. Counterpositioning. Amazon's patient capital model, investing in infrastructure and customer experience while reporting losses funded by negative working capital, is structurally incompatible with traditional retail. A traditional retailer, Walmart, Target, Macy's, stocks inventory in stores, pays suppliers on terms, and generates working capital from the spread between customer payments and supplier payments. But the physical store model requires enormous capital investment in real estate, inventory, and labor. Amazon's warehouse model requires less capital per unit of revenue and generates a larger float per unit of revenue. A traditional retailer can't adopt Amazon's model without closing stores, which destroys foot traffic, which destroys the core business.
And this is why the retail apocalypse of the 2010s happened. Traditional retailers could see Amazon's model was superior. They couldn't adopt it without destroying their existing business. So they tried to add e-commerce on top of their store model, which generated all the costs of both models, with the advantages of neither. Sears, JCPenney, Toys R Us, Borders, they all went bankrupt trying to compete with a model that was structurally incompatible with their own.
The thing I find most analytically interesting about Amazon's power composition is how the powers reinforce each other, and how the flywheel is the connective tissue. Scale economies reduce costs, which enables lower prices, which drives volume, which strengthens network effects. Network effects increase selection, which attracts customers, which strengthens switching costs through Prime. Switching costs lock in customers, which provides the volume base for scale economies. And the counterpositioning of the patient capital model prevents traditional retailers from disrupting the flywheel.
It's a closed system of compounding advantages. Each power feeds the others. To beat Amazon, you'd need to attack all four powers simultaneously. Nobody's figured out how to do that.
Nobody's tried and survived.
And if you're fascinated by how these compounding powers work together, the online course at svstrategy.exyz has an interactive 7 powers analysis tool where you can map out any company's advantages and see exactly where the reinforcement loops are. Plus, mystery company simulations, quizzes, and the era context for every decade we cover. That's SV, short for Silicon Valley, strategy.xyz.
SVstrategy.exyz, really useful for building strategic intuition. I want to go deeper on 3 threads from the Amazon story because each one has direct implications for founders.
Go.
First, choose your initial market analytically, not emotionally. This is the 20 categories against 5 criteria framework. Bezos didn't start with books because he loved books. He started with books because the selection asymmetry between online and physical retail was largest in books. The analytical framework, which product category maximizes the structural advantage of my distribution model, is applicable to any business.
And the corollary, the initial market isn't the final market. Bezos always intended Amazon to sell everything. Books were the entry point, not the destination. Starting with books gave Amazon the operational foundation, the warehouse systems, the customer base, the logistics relationships, to expand into every other category. The first market should be chosen not only for its inherent attractiveness, but for how well it positions you to expand.
Second, use your shareholder letter as a strategy document, not a financial summary. Bezos's 1997 letter did something remarkable. It set expectations with investors about how Amazon would operate for the next two decades. By being explicit about long-term orientation, about sacrificing profit for investment, about measuring cash flow instead of earnings, Bezos selected for shareholders who aligned with his strategy and deselected those who didn't. The letter was a filter.
And this is replicable. Any CEO can use communication with investors as a strategic tool, not to spin or deceive, but to be so clear about the company's operating philosophy that the wrong investors self-select out and the right investors self-select in. The shareholder letter is an underutilized strategic instrument.
Third, when in doubt, invest in the customer experience. This is Bezos's most repeated principle, and it's backed by a structural argument. Customer experience improvements, faster delivery, lower prices, more selection, compound over time because they increase customer loyalty and reduce acquisition costs. Marketing investments depreciate, the effect of an ad campaign fades. Infrastructure investments, fulfillment centers, delivery networks, recommendation algorithms, appreciate because they make the customer experience better on every subsequent order.
The flywheel starts and ends with the customer. Every dollar invested in customer experience accelerates the flywheel. Every dollar invested in something that doesn't improve the customer experience is friction that slows it. Corporate strategy takeaways from Amazon Part 1.
The big one is the relationship between the flywheel and patient capital. We've seen flywheels before in this course, the MS-DOS flywheel from the Microsoft episode, the network effects flywheel in the Intel ecosystem. But Amazon's flywheel is distinctive because of how Bezos financed it. The negative working capital provided the cash. The 1997 letter provided the permission. And the combination allowed Bezos to run the flywheel at a loss for years while the competitive position got stronger. Most founders understand the flywheel concept. Very few understand the financing and governance structures required to actually run one at scale.
And the implication for founders is, if you're going to run a flywheel strategy, you need to solve three problems simultaneously. First, you need the flywheel itself, a genuine self-reinforcing growth loop. Second, you need a capital structure that allows you to invest through the early unprofitable rotations. And third, you need an investor base that supports long-term value creation over short-term earnings. Bezos solved all three. Most founders solve one and wonder why the flywheel doesn't spin.
The second strategic lesson is about Prime as a switching cost mechanism. Before Prime, Amazon customers had no reason not to comparison shop. Every purchase was a new decision. After Prime, comparison shopping feels wasteful. You've already paid for shipping on Amazon. Why would you pay for shipping somewhere else? Prime converted a transactional customer base into a subscription customer base. And subscription customers are worth dramatically more than transactional customers because their lifetime value is predictable and their switching costs are real.
And the lesson generalizes. If your business has transactional customers, customers who make discrete purchase decisions with no ongoing commitment, you're in a structurally weak position. Any competitor who offers a better deal on any given transaction can steal the customer. But if you can convert transactional customers into subscription customers through a membership, a prepaid plan, an ecosystem of benefits, you create switching costs that protect you from transaction-by-transaction competition. That's what Prime did. It turned shopping into a subscription. Let's land this key takeaways from Amazon Part 1.
My first takeaway is the flywheel framework, a self-reinforcing growth loop where each output accelerates the next input, creates compounding advantages that are nearly impossible to replicate. But the flywheel must be genuine. Every link in the chain must be real and operationally executed. Drawing a diagram isn't the same as building a machine. and the flywheel requires patient capital to get spinning. Amazon's flywheel worked because the negative working capital and the 1997 shareholder letter gave Bezos the financial and governance runway to invest through years of losses. The flywheel without the financing is just a PowerPoint slide.
My first takeaway is the negative working capital framework. If you collect from customers before paying suppliers, revenue growth generates free capital. This is the mechanism that allowed Amazon to invest in infrastructure while reporting losses. And it's the mechanism that traditional retailers couldn't replicate without restructuring their entire supply chain. For founders, model your cash conversion cycle. If it's negative, you have a structural advantage most competitors don't. If it's positive, you're funding growth out of pocket, which limits how aggressively you can invest.
My second takeaway is about the 1997 letter and long-term orientation as competitive advantage. Bezos didn't invest blindly in the future. He invested in specific infrastructure and behavioral changes, fulfillment centers, Prime, the marketplace, that had quantifiable expected returns on multi-year time horizons. The patience wasn't about temperament, it was about math. But the math only works if your investors will let you run it. And that's why the letter matters. It self-selected an investor base that supported the strategy. Long-term thinking without investor alignment is just a CEO who gets fired in year three.
Well, and my second takeaway is about Bezos's analytical rigor at founding, the 20 categories evaluated against 5 criteria. He didn't start with inspiration. He started with a decision matrix. And the framework produced the right answer. Books, the category with the largest selection asymmetry, the lowest purchase risk, the most standardized product, and the most consolidated supply chain. For founders, the starting market matters enormously. And the best way to choose it isn't intuition, it's analysis. What category maximizes my structural advantage? That's where you begin.
And the last one, the regret minimization framework isn't a business strategy. It's a life strategy. Bezos didn't use it to decide whether to sell books or music. He used it to decide whether to start at all. When you face a decision with asymmetric downside, where the cost of trying and failing is low, but the cost of not trying is existential regret, you should try. The worst case is you fail and learn. The worst case of not trying is you never know.
And 25 years later, Relentless.com still redirects to Amazon.com. The name he didn't choose tells you everything about the man who built it. I keep thinking about the regret minimization framework and how it connects back to every founding story we've told. The traitorous 8 leaving Shockley. Jobs returning to Apple. Page and Brin turning down the Excite deal. And Bezos, writing a business plan from the passenger seat while Mackenzie drives to Seattle. Every great company in this course was started by someone who decided that the risk of not trying was worse than the risk of failing.
The common thread isn't genius, it's courage. Throughline 5, the flywheel is unit economics in action. Lower prices attract more customers attract more sellers expand selection. Each turn makes the next turn cheaper. And throughline 7, long-termism compounds. Bezos played a 20-year game and Wall Street called him crazy every quarter. He was right. They were wrong. So, before we go, if the flywheel concept and negative working capital blew your mind, the online course at svstrategy.exyz has an interactive simulation where you're building an e-commerce company and deciding when to launch Prime, when to open the marketplace, and how aggressively to price. You make the calls before seeing what Bezos actually did. That's svstrategy.exyz.
SVStrategy.xyz. Next time, Amazon Part 2. AWS, the cloud, and the most accidental $1 trillion business in history.
It wasn't accidental, it just looked that way.
See you next time.